sitting here about time. About the measurements of years, days, months, etc. Specifically, it's about the word moment and what it implies. Moment is the common word for the shortest division of time and implies movement, mass. It seems to be true that all material is constantly in a state of change, from create, to decay. This is an example of a good bit of phonetic thinking and shows how thinking phonetically can help to solve things that would otherwise be problematic. Can-tie-m-t-i-e M be seen as a binding factor in the constantly changing rotation rate? We said on other occasions that this T letter signifies a crossing where the two lines represent forces travelling at right angles to each other. We do find an old symbol made of three T's, which is related to the one in the other man, and we find one in heraldry made of four T's, called a cross potent, where it is said that the T's are crutches. And if you know something of the tradition about the devil going about on crutches, and the time process itself being a crippling process on eternal power, these things can be tied together. We pronounce M with the lips closed and say that M equals substance, because when we circumscribe a force, we bring into being the possibility of an individual standing on the perimeter of that rotation and defining that below his feet as substantia, that which is underneath his standing. That would then be equivalent to substance. TM would then mean the crossing of forces in a closed system or time. So we have here a statement about key, create, and DK. T and K are very closely related. If we imagine a wall and then a force hitting that wall, we have the significance of the letter K, where K equals kick and keep. Now in T we don't bother about the idea of keeping the forces together. We just allow that one force and another force are propagating at right angles to each other. If we draw a circle, let the perimeter stand for the top of the T, any radius in it is a force going from the centre to the perimeter, and that would mean the tying of the perimeter to the centre. But we would not be concerned with keeping it there. If we imagine the hand of a clock to go round in various moments of time, it is describing T throughout that substance, that is T and N, that is, it is describing time. But if we want to keep it in one place, then we must not allow it to rotate, we must nail it together, and then we use the letter K to symbolize it. When we put K and T together, as in the Greek prefix ket, as in catalepsy and so on, we find a symbol meaning fixity, and the symbol meaning the passing of forces across each other, and therefore the fixation of forces crossing each other. the animal called the cat is so called because its motions are all staccato. You notice that the cat concentrates on whatever it's doing from moment to moment, and as soon as the cat has exhausted the meaning of a given phenomenon, it turns away from that one to another one. It never turns gradually from one percept to another. You find its behaviour is quite other than the behaviour of a dog in this respect, because a dog allows its attention to go over a lot of people, one after the other, in a continuous change of direction. But the cat doesn't do that. The cat always switches its attention suddenly. It hears a bird outside, it turns the whole of its attention on the bird. It may hear a rustling of paper in the room, it forgets the bird and turns on to the paper. It's because of this activity that it is called a cat. So if we talk about time, we're talking about the passing of radial forces along the perimeter. And if we're talking about the keeping of time, we're talking about the whole confining process. In the word take, which is the reverse of this, you have a fundamental idea to do with time, because the suggestion is there is a crossing of forces onto an already fixed situation. Now, when we consider the word moment, we are considering a root men, meaning to count, to evaluate, and a word mo, meaning substantial zone, or zone of substance, and the passing of force. Now this moment implies that there is a crossing of forces being counted in a zone of substance. If we put a V in between it, and the phonetic E asks it to pronounce it, this V means to develop. So if we take a moment and develop it, it must always go into another moment. Let's look at the clock for a moment and consider that when the hand of the clock moves, we are led to believe that it moves continuously only if we don't examine its actual motion. If we put the motion under a microscope, we will find that it's vibrating. We know in fact that it's being driven by little cogwheels, and each little wheel gives it a kick. We actually find that finger going round the clock ticking. And each one of these little ticks we would call a moment. We get a similar idea in the turning moments that architects have to study. And if we apply a force at right angles to the radius, and thus push the hand of the clock one point, the amount of energy needed to push it that fundamental distance we could call a moment, and that would coincide roughly with the meaning given to it by engineers and architects. If we take a lever and we drill a hole in its middle, suspend it on that point so that it's in perfect equilibrium, and then we put on it a little weight, very tiny weight, and that weight isn't heavy enough to overcome the friction on the point of suspension, then the lever will not move. But if we increase the weight so that it's heavy enough to overcome the friction, then it will begin to move. And we say it begins to move in a moment, which means that the substance in the situation in which those forces are crossing has now caused an appreciable difference, a phenomenal difference, one that the sense organ can perceive. So when we're applying a force, by weight or directly, by pressure, a definite amount of force is required to overcome a definite amount of resistance, and that amount of force we could call a moment. and the concept of a turning moment is related to this one. We have similar things in architecture, because we have to build very often with beams, and they act as if they were levers. If we support a beam at a certain point and then put a great weight on the projecting part of the beam and keep piling it on, eventually the beam will tilt. And at the moment it begins to tilt, we have evidence of the force being sufficient to overcome all the counterbalancing forces on the other side. When we're talking about time, we are talking not abstractly, in real terms we are talking about substance doing something, that is forces crossing in such a way that we can actually count them. If we couldn't count them, we could not talk about moments or about movement. The fact that the M-E-N occurs in the word tells you that we're dealing with counting processes. If we took a continuous line with no vibration in it at all, actually there isn't such a line, but if we pretend for a moment there is one, we call that an abstract line. It is continuous and infinite, goes right off the paper in both directions forever. We could not count it. It would be an infinite continuous line, and consequently not countable. We couldn't even call it one line, because we would not be able to find the ends of it if it were infinite. So we would have to call it a not two line. The concept of non-dualism would be evoked. But if we allow this line to vibrate or to ripple, then we can count the wave crests and the troughs, if we wish, in between the crests. So in order to count at all, we must produce a difference. And difference is, this dip is the same as duality, and this fair, whether it's fair from bear or fakire to do, implies the same thing. It is doing or bearing to. And if it isn't doing or bearing to, then it cannot be counted. There must be a difference between the trough and the crest in the altitude before we can begin to count. Now, when we're dealing with visual space, we are dealing with a very abstract concept, because we are doing something as adults that the baby does not do. We tend as adults to define space as that which is between bodies. The bodies, material bodies, are more important to materialistic people than the space between. Space is only thought of in general by materialists as something in which to store bodies. And the space is infinite and the bodies are finite. The bodies are circumscribable and therefore locatable. You can get your hands on them. They are visual and they are tangible experiences. All the space in between is of no use to a materialist, except in so far as he can use it for storing material bodies. This is an adult way of thinking of things, because the adult has been directed to the secondary kind of activity of a living being, namely the preservation of its life through acquiring commodities, food, shelter and so on. But before the adult has been stressed on the object as a second need, his first need is immediate self-preservation, like fight or flight. The second need is a job, to get yourself some matter to eat. Before this stress is placed upon the being, in a newborn baby, we find experimentally, and we can see it quite easily with a new baby, that the baby does not focus on material objects as such. It has no concept of material values and of space as separate. from those bodies. The child, therefore, when you watch it, a newly born child, is rather alarming because its eyes don't focus on objects, they don't focus on mother or father, and they don't focus on any tangible, and they roam about quite independently initially, to the bewilderment of new mothers who've not seen it done before. And the child seems to pay as much attention to space as it does to bodies. And as this is a prime experience of a child, we have to consider it as valid at its own level. Now, you often notice that cats and dogs, cats more often than dogs, look into space and then suddenly jump out of the way as if there was something there. And therefore they've got a reputation for being a bit queer because of it. Now, we tend to think that space has nothing in it. And really we mean nothing important for us at the moment. We are so used to focusing on the object, and we have developed an eye to enable us to do that, that we ignore space as a determinant, except as a storage zone for materials. And if we actually look between objects instead of at them, we discover that we get visual sensations that we don't get if we look at the object. We can do it now, we can do it immediately in this room if you like to do. If you look, say, 4 or 5 feet away in the air, you will become very quickly conscious of motion in the air. You may think it's motion of dust particles. Of course, there are dust particles there. You wouldn't normally notice them. But if we get a perfectly dust-free room and you repeat the experiment, you will find you will still get visual sensations from the space. And you will also begin to see little lights running about in space. One investigator has related these little lights, which he calls photons, which means little lights, to the biological forces of sex. And he's not wrong in so relating them, because light itself is life. The light and the life are two different aspects of a prime force. Now, in the last part of this question, can time be seen as a binding factor in the constantly changing rotation rate? Here, the questioner has seen that time is an anagram of time M. It is also an anagram of MITE, the small. And this mite, the littlest thing, is the same concept as the least time division. If we don't circumscribe a zone, and thus substantiate, if we don't tie M, we cannot generate tie me, which is the observer. We can only focus where there is an actual rotation of force. But that force, in order to be rotating at all, and in order to be tied, must be, in principle, an untiable force, which somehow has got tied. So if we draw a line for the tied force, and then say, why bother to tie it? We'll draw the line extended, without tying it. We then have the idea of a translating force. Translating force is one that keeps laying itself across space instead of localizing itself in a zone which prior to its rotation and localization didn't exist. You notice in Norse mythology the devil is named Loki. Now Loki is exactly the same as the location that you get in the Latin. It is the finiting principle. To be tied to a locus, to a place, is automatically to be finited. There are two ways of expressing the same concept. We can see then that when there is a tied substance, we have a tied process, and for any observer, a tying of me, me being the objective form, of which the subjective is I. So if we take I, that's our breath of the I, and we take the concept of me, me is the object. This letter I is a translating force. That letter I, translating, goes along and then turns itself around and makes itself into me. This means that there is no separate me from an I. Wherever there's a me, there is necessarily an I to perceive it. And what that I is perceiving, it's simply itself, finiting itself by circumscribing itself. This is the meaning of absolute subjectivity. And states that absolute consciousness, which is spirit, objectifies nothing other than itself. And the only way it can objectify is by circumscribing itself. This means that the limitation imposed on ourselves as body, you say my body, or a child says me when he falls over and bangs himself, this limitation imposed is a self-limitation by consciousness. An I has rotated some force within itself. We might think that this is rather a strange thing to do and doubt our capacity to do it. But we know that we can do it, because if we look around the room and choose to look at a given person, first of all we experience a sense of going out, that is a translating force in consciousness, and when it comes to the object, then it runs round, circumscribes the object. This is a fact of our experience. We get the eye, and the eye attention goes out, and then it goes round the person it's looking at. And as long as your attention is on the person, there is a force going round either the whole or a portion of that being. And if that force were to stop for a moment from going round, you would become unconscious of the object. We have a simple demonstration of a translating force, an I, becoming a me by simply rotating. And that tells us how to get out of me, the object, which is both accusative and dative grammatically. You can hit it, or you can give it things, according to whether you're accusing it or treating it datively. In order to get out of that me, all you have to do is stop circumscribing, stop defining. Let's look at another word, the word statement. When we are talking, if we're not careful, we will be making statements. And a statement is a counting of forces crossing each other statically. And this tat, which is good German for deed, with an O in it, is good German for death. To say we're dead. To sound shift from D's to T's. So a state is static. And as such, is an illegitimate locus being treated as if it had validity from itself. So any statement that we may make is necessarily static and therefore false. Now if I made a statement when I said any statement is necessarily static and therefore false, that would be false too, if it were a statement. But we have to examine it very carefully to see whether I did actually say anything static. And in fact, the implications are not static. To the contrary, they are an undoing of the static. If we say that this S is the undulation of spirit, and then we put the T on it, like Moses did with the serpent in the desert, to which Christ refers, we take this undulating motion and we put a T on it, then we take the flux of spirit, the flux of life, and by crucifixion, by towing it, we fix it. In the act of fixing it, we have allowed it to come into a state. That is to say, we have made it static. And for a moment, that is for a crossing force accountable in a closed zone, we have an object of attention. Imagine the absolute undulation, going about anywhere and nowhere, and then deciding a pedal with that, we'll rotate a bit, and then we'll cross inside the rotation, and we'll use this cross as the basis. That is another form of the letter T. Now, in the fact of rotating, we have brought to B, that's the letter B, a zone. Zone means zealous unification, actually. The power is zealously going round and making a one in that place. It is a locus because we have tied L, K, kept in and established that power. Power to a rotation, there is absolutely no location whatever in infinity. And when we were talking about the way an adult sees space as that in which we store commodities when we're in business, he said it was really an abstract idea and that the baby doesn't do it. The baby is just as much aware of the space between as it is of the bodies. And it isn't until, by extension of the hand, that it finds a resistance in the hand, correspondent with certain visual sensations, that it develops the idea that there are resistant objects, which later it will learn to call material objects, and some non-resistant at the tangible level called space. But the child knows, like the cat knows, and the pigeon knows, and everybody else in the instinctual level knows, that space is every bit as important as bodies once its proper function is realized. Supposing we do a painting now, or a drawing. There is a rule in painting that if we do a little condensed or concentrated mass of color or tone, very small one in one corner, we can balance it with a large mass, not so intense, of another tone. Now, when we look at this picture, we found a very intense spot and the same amount of blackness spread over a larger area in the diagonal opposite corner, and we can see that our attention keeps moving across it. But the eye is tied to the visual sensation, the dark tone here and the grey one lighter here, and it tends to skip across the space as of no moment, that is, as not causing any turn or orientation. The orientation at the visual level of the adult, not the child, is towards the material object, and therefore the eye runs from this spot across space very quickly to the far corner of that grey mass and here, and then rotates around it and measures it. Now, in the visual arts and painting and architecture and so on, we talk about organizing space by means of form. Very simply, if I draw a curved arrow in one corner and then carry the curve right through and put a dot far away from it, although I have not actually drawn a line there, because the curve has a certain amount of inertia in it, it is doing what we call pointing at that dot, and the attention then goes across there, and we can show that we can produce almost a visual hallucination by doing this in a slightly more complex way. If I start to draw profile of a man like this, I go down, I don't touch the paper on the forehead, and I build it up from below with tones. You will begin to see, if you're not careful, connecting lines where none exists. I want to show this vector quality like the arrow. If I draw very carefully now the edge of this shape and make that shape point to where the eyebrow goes, I now pointing across that space, you can't help feeling at that moment that that forehead is straight. If you look at it carelessly and then you're asked to say what you've seen, you would actually believe that you had seen such a thing. If we wanted to make the space in between there not straight, all we have to do is vector a particular part of it slightly out, and then immediately the eye organizes the space between those two terms. So if I carry this one out a tiny bit more and then tip it like that on the bridge of the nose, it will alter the character of the space between there and there. And this is what we call the organization of space by form. Now the fact that we can do this visually could be explained by saying, well, in effect we have imported a thing out of the physical body, mass inertia, which we experience when we rush along and find that we can't stop immediately. We tend to carry on in the direction of motion, and therefore we unconsciously carry the attention over in the direction of the line until we come to an object. And being materially orientated, our whole attention is to find an object as a resting point. In all the visual arts we are concerned with organizing space by suggestion of form, the eye being concerned with avoiding material obstacles, is very, very concerned with the tone values and colours of objects, and therefore it is very ready to respond to any suggestion of direction at the visual level which would allow body motion to be conducted without impedance. But there is another kind of space, as one German fellow wrote in a book called Gibt es ein hoher Raum, or is there an auditory space? He noticed that while in the visual arts a line can produce the filling up of a space without actually filling it at all, in the case of music a tone actually fills that space. It does not leave it to your imagination, it actually fills it. And when you are looking at this board, these lines, and you find certain forms there and your interest is held by them in some measure, if you examine yourself you will find what you call attention is going out to the object, and you have to go out and look at it, and then a process of interpretation occurs inside you. And you have to work on it intellectually. And this is very, very important. You have to work on a visual impression intellectually. So we can say that the eye is a symbol of the intellect. So we can say the eye, first person, is also the symbol of the intellect. That an individual, as such, is an intellectual. That the moment you stress your individuality at all, you have stressed your circumscription in the ball of the eye, you have made an object for yourself whereby you know that you are that individual and not another, and at the same time in using this circumscription you have brought to be the possibility of radial moments, and therefore of the development of the diameter and the cross. Then we can start talking about ratio, and we can't talk about ratio until we circumscribe a zone. So when we circumscribe a zone we bring to be the I, the individuality, egotism, the finiting of the observer, and rational activity all at one go. Now you know that the devil's crime is supported by tradition to have been intellectual pride there would correspond exactly with ignoring infinity for whatever reasons, finiting himself, and then proceeding to rationalize his substance on the inside and say, I put myself in order as a finite being, and therefore I do not need any relation with any being outside myself. Now, a being who believes that he doesn't need a relation with any being outside himself is either absolute or self-deceived. If he's absolute, he doesn't need a relation with a being outside himself, because all beings are necessarily inside himself. But if he doesn't believe he's absolute and therefore infinite, he must believe that he is finite. And if he is finite, he must necessarily believe that he needs a relation with externality. Because every finite being that we know, in order to grow from a baby to a grown person, has to absorb energy from inside and push it out to its perimeter. The fact that we have to breathe and have to eat and have to have solar radiation on us and so on to make us grow shows that as finite, circumscribed beings, we are not independent. It is demonstrated that the egotist is deceived when he postulates that he is sufficient for himself as a finite. And if he realizes that he is not a finite, then the question of his relation to beings external to himself takes another form, and instead of being a relation of beings external to himself, it becomes a relation of beings internal to himself as absolute, so that he cannot in any sense escape the relation. Either he is finite and therefore needs external forces to maintain him, or he is absolute and all the bodies that there are internal to him and they are his relational problem within. And not within his finite physical body from which he starts, but within his consciousness. All the bodies in the universe are equally the property of the absolute. And therefore, if a man, say practicing yoga, climbs up and declares himself to be absolute, at that moment he has declared himself absolutely responsible for all the beings internal to absolute space. So whether one is finite or infinite, relations are still one's problem, either because one needs external force to maintain oneself, or because all finite bodies are within one's absolute consciousness. Now in the visual field, we always, as adults, tend to concentrate upon form and to organize space in works of art by vectoring the form, by pointing the form with a definite direction and stress. And in so doing, to create something in nothing. Because from the point of view of the materialist, space is nothing. The man pinned on his visual sense is therefore committed to an abstract analysis of the world in terms of material bodies. Now, if we had no experience other than visual experience, purely, and had never had any experience of tangibles, supposing we'd been born deficient in certain nerve endings, so that we never had a sense of touch or of resistance, the universe would be made up of light, of colours and shades and so on, but there would be no concept within us of a gross material body to stand separately from other bodies. It isn't until we come up against the fact of resistance that we construct the idea of external material bodies. Now, in the interspaces, when we look at the I and an object that is seen, we say in the theory of how we see things, a light shines on an object and is reflected into the eye and stimulates the retina at the back, produces certain processes in the brain which long experience have taught us to interpret as an object outside. this experience involves walking and stretching the arms and touching and so on. But the space in between here is ignored, and a process of intellectual evaluation takes place in interpreting the visual object. And when we come to music, we get something totally different. Instead of interpreting the thing intellectually, we do not find that we have to go out to the object and begin to think about the object. The object, the dynamic tones that come to us, although experienced as in space outside us and coming to us, are in fact felt as pressing in upon us and themselves doing the work. And the peculiar difference between the visual and the hearing experience is that in the visual experience, if I draw two squares, I shade one of them dark and leave the other one, these two things are seen visually and intellectually analysed, so that when I see them I say there is a white square adjacent to a black square. And there is no third resultant. Nothing happens. They don't quarrel. And yes, adjacent. The black one doesn't shout at the white one, and the white one doesn't shout at the black one. All we've had is a perfectly non-emotional experience where certain areas of the retina have been stimulated and intellectual processes of interpretation have been conducted and decided that unequal areas or unequal stimuli of areas of the retina have occurred, the result of the perception of two adjacent squares. But supposing we take two tones in music and we play them next to each other, like C and C sharp. Now, instead of C and C sharp lying side by side, together, without interfering with each other, and leaving it to us to say that is C and C sharp, and no third, instead of that we get interference, dreadful interference called dissonance or discord. And this interference actually occurs not only subjectively in our minds, like some psychologists think, but it also occurs outside the physical body from which we start reference, in the space. Because if we blow a discord on our magical instrument which we've got with us, we will find that if I blow it, I can hear it here, and everyone else in the room will hear it where they are, and if you move about in the room, wherever you move, you will hear this noise, this beautiful discord. And the fact that you can move about in space and that wherever you go these two will still fight each other in that space tells you that the space itself is full of this quarrel between these two tones. So whereas in the visual experience we have an intellectual and unemotional analytic process able to see things separately and produce no resultant of a third order, no quarrel, the moment we introduce musical tones, we start a fight in the substratum which vibrates when those tones are sounded. So that we are then, in the presenting of a musical relation, giving evidence that between the material objects which the intellect separates, the space is not nothing at all. The space between those objects is dynamic. When we look at the word space, we've dealt with this before, we've said the word ace is in it. And the word ace and the word h and the ache all refer to the same ultimate fact of the sentient, self-moving spirit. Space is spirit, and the spirit undulation is positing, that's the P, spirit. It goes along and then goes per. makes this rotation, goes along and does it again. Now this is S and P. Propagating. And every time it rotates, it makes a little point. And the little point is a power, positive zone, in relative motion. Point tells you that there is power in it, and that it is in relative motion. There are forces crossing each other to make it. So the word space means that this undulation goes along, then rotates, and goes on again, and that it is spirit. The word H, and the word H, and the word H, I-H, here, all give you different aspects of the same concept. Spirit itself is aching, and this aching is the cause of its waking up. Exactly the same concept and the same root. Spirit is aching. In terms of Paul's expression, that the whole creation travaileth and groaneth to be delivered from vanity. But not only is creation aching, but spirit itself aches to create, because it said, God so loved the world that he gave his son, etc. He so loved it. Now, a world is an order. Notice the "all" in world again. It is the word tied together, labouring, linking, and so on. Whenever it goes round, it creates a little order, and that little order is a world. And it goes on, it makes another world. And it goes on, it makes another. When we look at the astronomical facts, colossal nebulae, impossible distances. What we are seeing is a great undulation with a zone of rotating force, another undulation, a zone of rotating force, and so on. And each little rotation is a world, and at each point where the rotation begins, there, we have a turning moment. And all that we call moments of time are simply these rotation points which appear as in pulses. We change the N to M before the labial, like P or V. So we say impulse instead of in pulse, simply because P is pronounced on the lip. It is easier to say impulse than in pulse. So there is an impulse because there has been a rotation. And every impulse is what we call a moment of time. Now, throughout infinity, this undulating spirit is passing on and rotating. I've drawn these rotations fairly far apart on here, which would suggest that they're on a long wave frequency. Factually, those are so very, very tiny that I can't draw them on the board without them interfering with each other. And thus it appears that moments of time are adjacent to each other in the world of tangibles. Nevertheless, they still follow this same pattern. Also, the direction of them changes from moment to moment. It's a kind of alternation of direction. Once it goes round clockwise, and the next it goes round widdishing. So there's a continuous reversal of events in every moment. Time itself is also the word emit, and it is emissions of energy that we measure in moments of time. In your nervous system itself, there is an actual release of a definite quantum of energy every moment of perception. If that energy is blocked, it can actually be blocked by psychological tricks and by mechanical tricks. For that period, we won't call it a moment because it isn't turning in this sense. For that period, the being would be unconscious. let us say it would be objectless, because the object is created in the rotation, and as soon as the rotation has occurred, it goes out, and in between there is no thing, there is an undulation, and then there is another. Now, if we look at two ideas that are quite distinct, like democracy and aristocracy, when we consider them, we will always find between the two ideas no idea. And this no idea is not nothing, but it is undulating spirit. And space is that which is between these gross material bodies and that in which the bodies are stored, according to materialistic thinking. But in actual fact, that space between is spirit. So that between every two ideas, there is spirit dynamically moving. Spirit is vectored, spirit is going from one idea to another idea. If we want to make this diagram a little truer, we can make another undulation, turn around the same point and go away, and so on, and see how we associate ideas, and how we free ourselves from an association chain which has a definite direction and therefore inertia, and therefore a tendency to repeat itself. To free ourselves from that by remembering that the space between is no idea at all, and therefore by practicing interspacing, which we've discussed before, interspacing of ideas, we can increase our awareness of the dynamism of space. So if we take an idea like a man with a horse and cart, and we let the man, horse and cart be in the mind, and then we let the man unharness the horse and take it away, leaving the cart alone, and then the man comes back and takes the cart away, and then there is nothing. That no thing which is there is spirit. If you can hold it, instead of allowing objectification, you have the creative origin of all ideas and all things. But if the inertia of your organism and previous activity is too great, you will find that when you try to hold it, another idea will present itself. It will do so precisely because spirit is dynamic. It will not stand still. That will be a state. That will be static. Spirit is dynamic. What you can do with spirit is cause it to dodge in between the ideas. In other words, by practice, you can feel yourself about to make a statement, about to define the situation. Remember that definition and statement is death, is locking up, is finiting, and as soon as you feel yourself about to define, to inhibit the definition, and be on your guard against the next definition which will try to present itself. And as you inhibit this tendency to define, you will discover not that you know less, but that you know more. As you inhibit definitions on the plane of your usual mental life, you will discover there are a lot more ideas above it than you knew about. If you then practice again the interspacing trick, you will discover there are more ideas above that. And you will unconsciously be changing your frequency. If you concentrate on the gross material body, one you can touch, then your frequency is the lowest that you can have. If you concentrate on the idea about it in your mind, the frequency has gone up. If you concentrate on the emotional relationship between two, it goes up higher still. If you concentrate on the rational statement that all these things are necessarily functions of the superspace, which is spirit, pure dynamism, then the whole of your intellectual life is lifted up to a new level. And if you then place yourself in the field, absolute, you will experience an emotional, intellectual, dual experience of form and feeling simultaneously, in which all the bodies will be co-presented in one moment. That is, you will see the universe itself turn with all constituent parts within it in that one moment. Now, just in order to remind ourselves and make sure that we can understand this fact,
that the tones do not behave in the same way that visual images do. We'll blow a note on here. And the thing is to notice that when we blow on here, the thing comes to you and you do not have any intellectual object upon which to pin yourself. When I did the drawing of the man's profile here, you referred to something in your memory, a category of beings called men, as interpreted with pencils. And that was an intellectual act. Now, if I blow a note on here, you will find that there is no intellectual process, no spontaneous attempt to find out anything about it intellectually, but the thing itself comes to you, you feel it to be outside your physical body in its origin. You can actually locate it in the dark with your eyes closed if you want. So it definitely has spatial existence. But at the same time, it's coming to you through moments. That means impulses, emissions of energy. It is beating the medium between this instrument and you in a definite manner. If I play this C here, you hear there something, but your intellect is in abeyance. And you all feel that, in fact, you do not think about that in the way that you have to think to interpret a square visually. Now, we said that when I did the two squares visually, the white and the black, you saw them as a white and black square and nothing else happened. They didn't fight. The retina itself is so arranged that adjacent parts of it are stimulated and in some measure insulated from the motions of the other parts. But when we put two tones together, which are all right separately, they are not all right together. Now, either of those tones in isolation is all right, but if I put both together, then a quarrel begins. And if you listen very carefully, you will find the quarrel is not your quarrel, but it's a quarrel between the tones. I say this because certain psychologists have actually suggested that the dynamism of musical tones is subjective, meaning belonging to the individual only, and not a matter of the tones. Now, if you listen very carefully, you will find that the quarrel is between the tones themselves. Quarrel is not entirely your own handiwork. It is a genuine quarrel between the two tones. Also, when I blow one of these, if we walk around the room, we will hear it in any place in the room, and so we can say that that tone is filling all the space in the room. The space in the room, therefore, must be dynamically beating out that tone. If we then play another one in the same place, this tone will fight in the same places as the other tone, only because of a different character of the two tones. And from the acoustical point of view, the difference is a difference of frequency, which means if the frequencies are too close, they will be trying to move dynamic space in the place where they are in contrary directions simultaneously. And that will be the cause of the quarrel. As if you were to try to move your hand up and down simultaneously. Remember, your physical body is only a behavior of space, where space, remembering the ace in it, equals pure dynamism, initiative, power, or spirit. Now, if we play two notes that are far enough apart, we find that they do not quarrel in the same way that they do when they're close together. Here's a fifth. You had another note there, I think, as well as those two, which was a resultant one. It shows you another funny thing about this dynamic space. that when the two tones are beating together in the same place, they can beat up between them another vibration, the result of the two. And this is totally different from the visual experience of space. Now, because of this peculiar factor about tones, philosophers, from Pythagoras and earlier than that, he's an example of a man whose fragments have survived. Philosophers of that kind have suggested that music is somehow heavenly, celestial. We know that in all the great religions, music has been used from the very beginning to induce emotional states, non-intellectual states, that emotion is not an intellectually perceived thing, that music is not intellectually perceived, and therefore music is a method of shifting you out of your devilish, analytical, rationalizing centers. Hence it's used by the church. Now, there is another peculiar fact, that the tones, when considered not acoustically but musically, are dynamic in the sense that they are trying to go somewhere. If we consider tone acoustically, we are considering the thing simply as a phenomenon of vibration, frequency. But when we consider it musically, we are concerned with the direction in which it apparently wants to move. So if I play two notes here, which is a seventh, the seventh one is shouting out for the octave. You will hear it. You see, you get an immediate sensation that this is right, when if I play a note, then the seventh, and then put the octave in and take the seventh out, as the seventh disappears, you will feel, now it is all right. Now, this phenomenon of the octave has been called by musical theorists the miracle of the octave, because the octave is not musically different. That is, its dynamism is exactly the same. I take the note called the fifth and play that. That fifth demands the tonic, and that tonic is the tone, the unity principle of the scale, the T1 principle of the scale. So when we play the fifth, it demands either an octave up there or down there. It doesn't matter whether it goes up or down. So we say the peculiar character about the fifth in the octave is that it will move either up or down to the tonic. And it doesn't care. That means that the tonic is not important as up or down, but as unity principle. There's something very, very peculiar about musical tones. They are not just frequencies. They are frequencies which, when played together in certain ways, shout out for what we call resolutions. They shout out for returns to unity. We take a concept, a tone, we introduce another note into it. And when we introduce this note, you will hear a sort of threatening sound. Now, as soon as the... when I've heard it F sharp, that it's threatened. So this isn't quite right. And the reason it isn't quite right is because the relation of the individual being constitutes a peculiar pattern of tones. Every particle inside our body is vibrating at a definite frequency. You know that on a tape recorder with various speeds, we can produce Mickey Mouse effects by recording at a slow speed and playing back at a double speed. Supposing we get two recorders and we record a note, and then we keep doubling it up higher and higher and higher and higher, we will still have the same dynamism within it, but we can push the thing up till it goes out of audio frequencies. It will still be there, but we will not be able to hear it because the ear will be too coarse. But if we push this back below the atomic level, down to primary motions, we will actually be at the level at which, if we could hear it, then we would be experiencing the constituent vibrations of subatomic impulses in our own bodies. Now, a human being has got a lot of parts. Each part is vibrating in its own peculiar way. If we take the smallest part, and therefore the smallest vibration in a human being, and we count those up in the body, there'll be a very, very great number. But because of the grouping of these things, the subatomic parts give rise to atoms, these give rise to molecules, and these to proteins and organic structures and so on, all of which are compounds of this fundamental frequency. And each time we put a group of frequencies together, we are really lowering the note. So in that sense, we can say that if we draw a circle for top C, we could draw another circle with three circles inside it and say that is another C lower down, and then take a group of those and draw another C. We'd always have a circular form, but inside there'd always be a great number of these impulses. And we could say, cut the impulses in half each time, and thus show that the octave is always half the vibration in the lower octave than it is above, or is double in the higher to the one below. This means that inside the human being there are in fact sounding simultaneously complex structures, either concordant or discordant. This leads to the possibility of a religious significance and a therapeutic significance in music. Musical tone is dynamism, that means say it is pointing. You know that Socrates complained about the behaviour of certain Greek musical modes. Certain modes, that is scales, have certain emotional effects and they can cause lassitude. Another mode will cause sensuality. Another mode will cause a desire to go to war and so on. And these are non-intellectual experiences, they're simply emotional responses. And it means that the tones of those moods are, in effect, causing resonances within the very structure of the being itself. Supposing I play this triad here, this is C, E, and G. Now that feels quite comfortable and quite familiar. We've heard it up in there. If I now play the third one, a semitone lower, which gives us the minor, we feel immediately a little bit sad. Now, we haven't made an intellectual judgment. We're not that clever. We haven't counted the frequencies intellectually and said to ourselves, well, I don't like the number of beats per second on that E-flat relative to the E-natural. We're not that good at mathematics. So we are not doing it intellectually. The thing is doing itself, and we are being subjected to it. Now, if we lower it again and play in terms of minor third, play a second, I'll go down from the third, you'll see a quarrel, but at the same time a kind of relief that sadness has gone, because you're going to have to do something about the discord that results. There's the major one. I'm sorry, it blew a very high harmonica, very powerful. I go down from that minor third into the second. Can you hear there that there's not only a fight, but a promise that we might get home after all? Now, supposing we say the tonic note is the one that gives the unit to the scale, which is the one that we will return to at the end of the piece. That's our unity principle. We play it. We move away from it. Now, as soon as we play that second tone, we hear what we can call a direction implication, a dynamism. It wants to do something else. So if we play then the third, it sounds what we would call right. Now again, certain psychologists are trying to suggest it sounds right because we've heard it so often. And there is, in some degree, a possibility of that. But it isn't the whole truth. Because within itself, there are certain frequency relations that are requiring a return to the tonic. So if we play the tonic, and then the second, and then the third, and then back again, we'll feel what we would call a completion. So we feel that we've been away from home and come back again. Now this going away from home and coming back again is the basis of all that we call tonal music. This being at home, home is ho me, behold myself, the only place where I can get my own way. And then going away from it is already to advance towards possible danger. I've left home, immediately discord, and I've left the territory on which I can dictate. I climb out, find a temporary resting place, which is not quite right. I'll go a bit further to before. Well, that's not right either. I come to the fifth. I've still got to get back somehow. I can go up to the octave, to the sixth and seventh. Now, this is a very important thing because when we talk about tonality, about this principle of unity, we are talking about something in us which we need tremendously. We need unity. And if the unity we've got is only a temporary unity, it can be broken and it will be broken at some time. Now, supposing we talk for a moment that C was the only proper tonic, the only unity principle on the scale. And supposing somebody came along and said to us while we were trying to do it, that is not the true principle of the tonic, but D is. And started to prove it by going. Now he's got a unity out of D. That's no good us standing on C as essential unity, because the same ratio between the notes exists if we start on D. So anything can stand as a basis of unity, quite legitimately, but the unity of one thing is no ground for criticizing the unity basis of another thing. We can say that every scale, every ladder standing on a tonic is valid in and for itself, but its validity does not invalidate the tonal base of other beings. Now we've talked about the unique nature of individuals before and said that spirit makes everything unique, and this ties up again with spirit and music, because in music any tone, whatever, can stand as a unity base. And providing we keep the same ratio between the successive notes, we will get exactly the same effect in internal dynamism. And no matter how many scales we play, it will never invalidate another scale. Supposing somebody said, well, there are only seven notes really repeating, so there are only seven scales. Another man would say, well, there are semitones. We can start Neither on C or D, we start on C sharp if we want. And if somebody says, all right, so we've got 13 in an octave of semitones, 12 and the octave. Well, a man can say, well, we've got quarter tones. In between C and C sharp, there's another tone. We can start on that one. And in between those two, we've got eighth tones and sixteenth tones and so on. And then we'll start moving down to a fundamental of the high frequency, the short wave. And we will come down to the other frequency, which is the fundamental from which all the other scales are built up. In other words, we have a frequency universe with an aleph beat, which is the fastest one we can get, and then we can take a group of such beats and allow that to constitute a larger wave, and therefore a lower note, and treat that note as a tonic and build a scale upon it. And this we can do arbitrarily, but no matter how much we do it, we can never invalidate the use of another scale. So, if we want, as individuals, that is, as tonic bases, to be valid, we can never use our individuality as a ground for disallowing the individuality of another. And as all these different individualities are merely groupings of the absolute, the aleph frequency, then the man who claims to be moving towards absolute consciousness is moving towards this other frequency, which is the top ground frequency, groupings of which constitute the separate individualities of other beings. So that he actually becomes responsible, that is, able to respond to all the needs of all those other beings who are finite because group. The more he knows, the more sensitive he becomes, the greater his ability to respond to these patterns of frequencies, the greater is his responsibility for them. So we can never go like some of the German supermen misinterpreting Nietzsche and say that if I become more sensitive than you, you are no good. Because to become more sensitive is to move away from the long wave, low frequencies, towards the short wave, high frequency base. And all the long wave structures are merely compounds of these fundamental beats. And increase of sensitivity is simply increase of the awareness of the dependency of larger groups of frequencies, or low notes, upon higher ones. And once it is seen that the lower ones are dependent upon the higher, then the higher must remember that the lower are dependent upon it. And therefore the increase of responsibility with the increase of sensitivity. Now, we've only just come out of the 19th century, about 59 years, and in the 19th century, atomism, materialism, was the rule. And in that period, men were taught by so-called scientists, which means men crucified on the visual impression, that matter really existed in its own right. And that nature was simply a structure of material bodies, and that all these bodies were very busy, fortuitously crashing into each other, and that by a strange piece of illogicality, nature was red in fang and claw. These blind, fortuitously moving little ball bearings somehow were equipped with destructive appetites and fangs and claws. They imported a psychological significance into a purely materialistic point of view, which is quite invalid. Now, in 1926, in the Cambridge experiments, when the atom was exploded, then materialism became anachronistic, not only theoretically, but in practice. And there gradually arose, from that period, more and more consideration for space instead of body. Einstein had already begun to think about the space-time as a continuum, in other words, to give equal validity to time and space, and to make space-time a sort of unity in his unifield theory, so that space no longer became simply that in which you store the commodities when you've got a big business, but it actually was a dynamic substance itself. And here we would have to reinterpret the word substance means superstance, because it is fundamentally spirit. And it is this space-time which, by the emissions of the energy of the spatial substance, the ace spirit substance, produces the time process. And in Einstein's unifield, the curvature of space is related to bodies within that space. Curvature increases in relation with certain bodies in space. We think of our undulation process and then rotation, undulation, rotation. We can see that whenever there is a body, there must be an increase of curvature. Once we have said that space is spirit, and that it is only a false orientation to focus with your eye on what would be tangibly experienced if you walked up to it, and pretend that that is reality, and to ignore all the dynamism between you and it, because it isn't tangible at the gross level, once we have done that, we've cut ourselves off from the possibility of advancing in power control and movement towards the absolute. It was because atomism had failed in the pursuit of power that men began to knock on the atom. They were pursuing power. They went down like Cain did into the earth, and they thought, in the earth is power. So they collected the earth. That was their maker, their mother, their material. And then they beat on it and did manipulations with it, and suddenly it blew up in their face and disappeared. It refuted them. In the act of blowing up in that way, it revealed itself to be no more than compactions of force. And suddenly the universe, instead of being a material universe, became a dynamic field, and matter became no more than a little vortical spin. And compared with the colossal undulations, the little rotations occupy very, very little space. So really, there's very, very little matter in reality compared with spirit. The matter is just a little rotations, and between the rotations, the space is colossal. Thus, if you take the space in the atom, it is far in excess of the diameter of an electron or of a proton. If we take the solar system as one structure, the distance from the Earth, 93 million miles to the Sun, is considerably greater than the 8,000 miles diameter of the Earth. The solar system is almost entirely space. But that space is not nothing. And today's science knows that that space is dynamic. That between the Sun and the Earth, that is not the cold, dead void that they printed in the textbooks of 20 years ago, already anachronistic, of course, but that instead of being cold and dead, it is highly alive, charged with dangerous radiations, which you have to put your hat on. And they now realize that the whole concept of voidity, of vacuum, of emptiness, was a construct made through focusing on the tangibles in order to avoid damaging your gross material center of reference. Because the thing that makes the baby careful is pain. When it tumbles and bangs itself, it learns to distinguish between falling on the bed, which is nice, and falling on the brass knob at the end of the bed, which is nasty. And this painful experience causes it to distinguish between bodies hard or dangerous and bodies soft, not dangerous. So that in order to preserve itself, it has been forced into materialism, into the hard, gross matter. And that's for the baby to preserve itself. When it's grown up, and it has learned to circumvent these zones of high pressure that it causes in human bodies, then it is time for it to rethink the situation. Having preserved its vehicle of reference, its physical body, then it should refine that preserved vehicle of reference and no longer bother to worship the material negatively through fear, but to examine the dynamic nature of the space between bodies. And this can be done by increasing your awareness of space and the motions in space. Thus, if you sit next to somebody in a bus or a train, and instead of looking at the man's shoes and the pearl out of the corner of your eyes, if you compare the temperature of the man to begin with the lady on the right, by closing your eyes and just feeling that, you will discover that he's got a heat all around. Now, it's still a very material thing, but it is slightly more sensitive than detecting the gross material body. Now, if you then look at the space around that man's body, look at it with your physical eyes, you will discover little vertical spins of dust particles caused by the heat of his body. It doesn't need a lot of practice to do that, actually. Actually see the spinning of the air. And if the sunlight is at the appropriate angle, you will see it very, very easily. If you get in an artificial light like this, at certain angles in relation to certain objects, you will find that you can see it very easily. Once you've seen the dust particles, don't focus on them, but try and look between them, and you will discover that you can see lights dodging about in between the dust particles. And then you will become aware that the space is becoming surcharged, and you will have to remind yourself that it was so before you started looking at it, otherwise it will make you nervous. You naturally find that space is full of energies, and that you can see those with your physical eyes. Now, you know that the embryo echoes the development of the human race in broad outline from its earliest time. And in growing up through the state of childhood into the state of adulthood, it passes through earlier phases of perceptive level. And the child, before it has learned to focus on a gross material object, and it's still in its mother's arms and doesn't have to preserve itself, it is at the stage at which our ancestors were a long, long time ago, when they didn't distinguish gross material bodies as such. And they never banged themselves because, like the bat flying to a room with strings across it, doesn't touch them. They were so sensitive that they never banged themselves because they could feel the presence of that body like a congenitally blind person can. This means that the child actually has, we've all had as children, this experience. It's not something we will discover that we've never had before. It's something that when we regain it, we will remember that we've done it before. And in the process, we have taken a step towards this higher sensitivity of seeing the essential dynamism of space. Now, the moment you've got this dynamism of space firmly fixed in you, and the concept that a material body is only a rotation of a motion in this space, and the moment you take the focusing off the rotation onto the field, you are in a continuum, and a continuum has no part. And therefore all the bodies in that continuum are equally yours, if you are identified with the continuum. Therefore your responsibility to all those bodies is the same. And furthermore, your capacity for acting upon those beings is the same. At the absolute level, in other words, you can say, as Christ said, I and my Father are one. That absolute, that ace in space, is the Father. The sun is the first big rotation, the macrocosmic self. The little rotations inside it are us. If, instead of identifying with the little rotation of my individuality, I identify with the macrocosmic one, I'm identifying with Christ as the macrocosmic logos. If I identify with the Father, or that, the space itself, then I'm identified with the Father. And when Christ says that we should be one together as he is one with us and he is one with the Father, we in him and he in the Father, and so on, it is all a statement about the dynamism of space and the absolute
extempore is out of the time.
Yes.
From the time.
Does that suggest that the best music is not written down?
The best music is not written down. The best music cannot be written down. The notation on a piece of paper is an approximation to the composer's intention. It can very, very easily be misread.
Is that the correct interpretation of that phrase, extempore, then? Would you say it was outside the power of time?
Well, it's usually to the contrary. It means out of the time. And it's from the time. It means that the time situation... The time situation is speaking. You see, when a moment occurs, it gives you a stimulus and you speak on the stimulus. That's the usual meaning of extempore.
Because an unprepared speech is always better than a prepared one.
Well, prepared means prepared, which means rationally cut,
yes,
and therefore necessarily discreet. If you are linking by feeling, which is the only valid link, absolutely, because it is field awareness, then the mode of progression is not determined by the vertical points, but by betweenness. Just as in music, the dynamism is to do with the tones and the distance between them, called the interval. So in musical theory, we talk about intervals rather than about the notes themselves. An interval of a second, of a third, of a fourth, and a fifth, rather than of a note, C and D and E and so on. You see?
So the prepared thing is never so appropriate.
And it can't be by being prepared. You see, it's got it. In fact, the whole failure of the French, your French is prepared. The capital city is Paris, which is a Pirard function. It is built on a wheel, and their whole concept is intellectual, and therefore they abandoned the field because it was formless, and therefore abandoned the cause, and therefore went down the nick as a world power, and therefore fell down to need de Gaulle to help them up. You see? And until they get rid of this rational stress, they will not hit the top level. Whereas the Germans, who are Bosch, are still Herrenvolk, not Pirenvolk. They still believe in this power. We said before that Nietzsche was quite clear in his mind that as the rationalist is weaker than the man of will, the rationalist will always hedge the situation, surround it with definitions, and then try to hypnotize other people with his definitions, so that their will be paralyzed by his intellect. But the real Herrenvolk, the real men of will, know that the man is only making a reason because he hasn't got the power to do without. So they ignore his reason. Reason has moon, but moon is not hers, I mirrored on her sea.
But when they ignore his reason, have they understood his reason? Have they transcended it through understanding it? If we step above the definition, we can only step above that which we've understood, don't we?
Yes, but you see, these men at Herrenvolk know that the pyrarch is a function of the henna. Yes. The ripples on the surface are only the product of the pebble dropped from above.
I was thinking more of what you said earlier regarding doing the exercise. Well, when you feel yourself coming to the point of definition, this supposes that you know the definition which you're coming to the point of.
Now, what will happen? Before you can do that exercise, you will persist in defining through fear.
Which also validates the fact that we also must be quite clear about the definition that we're going to use.
You can't transcend it until you've done it.
This is what I'm talking about.
Remember, fear itself is a power function. the Buddhists were quite clear that the mind, their counter, rationalizer, is the organ of fear.
Yes.
And there's nothing in it except pains added up, saying, look out, dodge that one. There isn't anything else in the para, in the reason, other than records of pains experienced in situations stored up so that it won't happen again.
Mm.
So the whole structure is negative. But nevertheless, we have to evolve through those things. And because of being finite and identified with the finite, we feel impotent. And being impotent, we think in order to avoid the painful situation. And we go on thinking to avoid the painful situation until Christ comes along. And he says, don't think to avoid the situation, because that merely adds up in the mind another painful thought. You'll be in an eternal danger. Penetrate into the situation, find out why it is painful. Pain is point of refusal. What are you refusing there? Penetrate into it and discover that painful situation was a positive power. And by penetration, get hold of the power in the situation. Then it can't frighten you anymore, it can't rationalize you anymore, because you've got hold of the power. This shifts the accent of the rationalizing function onto pure will. For the will is no fool. Because a fool is already a pilot. Because a man who doesn't know the reason in the first place will go along, come to the precipice and fall over it. Now if he gets depressed about that, and turns fool into pilot and pilot into pyra, he won't go near crevices and precipices anymore. He doesn't. But if he's a proper fool, he'll keep walking. Every time he comes to one, he'll fall over. Come with him, he'll be going down, won't he? Not up. He must come to the substantial fact eventually, the point of return.
You were saying earlier that in the case of two discordant notes being played, that there was a distortion in space as well as in actually produced within the mind.
Yeah.
In the case of two different colours that actually clash, you get that effect produced in the mind. At the same time, each of those colours has a frequency of its own. It has a frequency of its own, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Notes, too, that are discordant have their own frequency.
Yes.
Is it not illogical to suppose that because the notes clash, because they're dissimilar in frequency, that the colours also clash in space as well?
You could say, if you like, that the colours clash in space, providing you are quite careful about what you meant by colour. You see, we know exactly what we mean about tone, and we cannot say that the experience of tone is the same thing as the experience of frequency. We cannot say that the stimuli on the retina are quite the same as the pigment on which the light is shining. Whatever the frequency is in colour, if it gets too close, we know it must interfere in space, because it is traversing space and it's being reflected from a surface. So if the colours are of such an order that they jangle in space, that would be discordant. But it isn't a discordancy of the musical order. Not the same thing. If we get red and something not quite so red, it's harmonious. If we get C and something not quite so C, it's discordant. So they're not analogous in that sense. There's something very, very mysterious about the relation between these two. They're almost opposite sides of a coin. Because adjacent colours are always harmonious, and adjacent tones are always discordant. You see, when we take the spectrum as split through a prism, and we play that out on a bar, on a line, we separate out certain colours, and it's disappearing into ultraviolet there, and into infrared there. And there are some visible frequencies. But that's an abstract trick. It isn't really like that in space. In the same space, there are many, many frequencies coming, and the eye is only adjusted to receive a very, very limited number of them. The ear is not perceiving the waveform, which is at right angles to the wave, as in light,
but the ear is selected to perceive the longitudinal push. So a light is travelling through space in waveform like this, at right angles to the wave, but sound is travelling longitudinally, beating, so that there cannot be identical experiences even when they're raised to the same frequency, because the same frequency experienced by the eye and the ear would be experienced literally at right angles to the vibration. The sound vibration being experienced at right angles to the visual vibration. So there cannot be the same experience. And the laws of the integration of the beating longitudinally of sound cannot be the same as the laws of the integration of the waveform crossing the line of propagation. That's why we have to be very careful of hasty generalizations from analogy. And some psychologists have to show there was a frequency for smell and one for taste and so on. That is true, but they're of a totally different order from tone sensations and visual sensations, and they haven't analyzed the kind of motion that is necessary to produce it. There's always a desire in the rational mind to get to the conclusion, so that now we know what it's all about. This causes rapid making of analogies and jumping to conclusions, so you get a base to stand on and then you can conduct your life from it, having solved the problem. And of course life is infinite, and therefore it is impossible to do that. What you have to do is put your feet in infinity and not bother to stand at all, knowing that standing is the same as being static. Accept the essential dynamism of your own being and be secure in your dynamic continuous insecurity. Because that's an inner security.
Question here about the unity of man. Sounds a bit Buddhistic in foundation. Is it intended to be on the Buddhistic base now? As man has no essential unity, will not this become a serious obstacle to his investigation of space? The forces ordering his behavior on Earth must surely be of different intensities elsewhere, and would not this produce a sudden disequilibrium, quite altering the behavior pattern of any individual? And by man here, if we say man has no essential unity, we must be referring to the individual man as an aggregate of forces. This of course would be a serious obstacle to investigation of space, because space itself is not made of discrete parts. So we'll draw an individual man for a moment. We'll make him a not very well integrated man with odd bits, and we'll say that this man has no essential unity because the formal structures in the zone of consciousness where this man is are actually not fitting each other properly. So we'll say he lacks integration. The question says, because of this lack of unity, will it not be an obstacle to this individual if he tries to investigate space? Now space is in between all the parts of his being. If he is identified with these behavior patterns within himself, then for him space will be what he would call a pure void. Remember, he will misuse the term, because the word void and the word empty and the word vacuum all mean leisure, even in a dictionary. All their roots go back to the same concept of leisure. Now, what is at leisure in emptiness, in voidity, in vacuum is force. And it can only be at leisure, not essentially, because force is never at leisure, It can only be at leisure relative to some Englishman. If it was an American, it would be at leisure. And this leisure part, the less here, really refers to the left, the passive. So it says that the force in the void is passive, and this can only be relative to some being either superior in power or at a different frequency and unable to appreciate the activity in the void. Now let's look at these three words a moment. We'll put the fourth one, space. We've already said that the ace in space means spirit. You can see in the word empty we have a substance and a point crucifixion relation across in the forces. In the word void we have the Greek root of form plus the glyph of transcendence. Void therefore means that which transcends form. In the word vacuum we have the root of voice. So in all these different words we are dealing with something beyond manifestation. When we translate manifest as made fast in order to be counted, manifest. In voidity there is form transcendence. We've already said that form is circumscription, and we've shown before that when force rotates it cannot go to a dead center, no matter how closely it approximates to it. As long as it is going round, it can't go to the center. What it does is go in and come out continuously to maintain a beam. In the center of every beam there is a void. Every circumscription always contains a void and fills a void in the circumscribing action and has a void outside it. If we had the sunyata concept from the Indian philosophers, Hinduism and Buddhism, the idea of the sunya or emptiness implies again an idea of transcendence. We are affirming a motion of spirit. And the statement is that form is void and void is form. Because if we go inside the circumscribing limit, as soon as we get on the inside of it, we come to void again. If we go from the immanent spirit, which is a void, outwards, we come to the action band, and then we go through that back into another void. If we like to represent all the beings in the universe in terms of circumscriptions, those circumscriptions are simply lines demarking voids, particularizing voids. It is then not very difficult to understand what the Buddhist concept of the equation form equals voidity means. As every form, FR, PR, and substance, PR is PIRAR, a rotating substance, form, as every form is necessarily a rotation, and every rotation simply circumscribes a void, then every form is void, and throughout the whole of so-called voidity we have a force which, when it appears as void to any finite being, does so only because the frequency of motions in the so-called void is too high for that individual to appreciate. If a man then identifies with a finite character in the field of his consciousness, supposing he's a bus driver, if he conceives himself as a bus driver most of the time, and some of the time a husband, and a small bit of the time a drinker of tea at the terminus, then he has three references. And if that's all he's got, he has no mode of relating the three together. He will not have a concept of voidity in himself as form, but he will believe that form is simply being a bus driver and being a home bed and being a tea drinker. In other words, when we identify with the form and attribute to the form substantiality, we are pretending that that substance is other than voidity. And then, beyond the limit of the circumscribed character, we say there is space, and we are postulating that this space has nothing in it, no force, and therefore is of no importance. We've said that space is really spirit. Space is dynamic. Space is that which produces all the modalities, all the rotations, which constitute spatial objects. Objectification is only sphericalization. Force just turns round, fills up a space, demarks the space with spherical action, and as long as it's twirling about spherically, that is a sphere in space, and it is made of ace. It is spirit rotating. Now, if we take the concept of Maya, which is usually translated illusion, and we split it phonetically down to its root mantric base, we have substance, activity, integration activity. Maya, which is supposed to mean illusion, is only illusion to the individual who cannot penetrate through the form presented. Maya is not only illusion, it is also said to be, say in the Bhagavad Gita and elsewhere, the means whereby God creates. He creates by substantialization, by activation of substance, by integration, activation. First he makes a substance, that's like clay, and then he puts a form actively into that substance. The whole universe of forms is then Maya, illusion. Now, an individual, which relates to the second part of this question, an individual in a given part of space is subject to certain orders of stimuli. And the stimuli can only cause to appear in consciousness things of similar resonance. So if we're in space A, then elements of space A in the being will resonate when the stimulus from space A comes in. Suddenly the man will become aware that he has elements A in him. If we now take him away and put him in another space, we'll call X, the A will become dormant, and X elements will resonate in him. This we can demonstrate in a variety of ways, with tones, and also with geometrical forms, and with colours. We can induce colour changes by putting a colour down, say yellow, and then painting, without touching the yellow colour, a red one by the side of it. Now, the moment we put the red one at the side of this yellow one will start to look slightly greenish, because the complementary colour of the red is green in the pigment level. If we then put a bright green on the other side of the yellow will start looking like a yellow again. The green will be so much stronger than the green tendency in the yellow that it will force the yellow back into its yellowness. And this tells us that without altering a given entity, we can cause it apparently to alter by altering its relations with other ones that we bring into being. So if a man knows A and B and C and they're not related together, if he goes into environment A, A will resonate and dominate his consciousness. B and C will lapse. If we then take him away and put him into another environment, B will work upon him. In another environment, C will work upon him. And as the external stimulus conjures up a reaction of the same order inside, so the man would think that he is changing his mind. We'll find a man, we'll let A represent for the moment the flesh pots of Egypt, or jolly activities with that. We'll let B represent going to church. Now he's going out and having a wild party, and he's going in a caravan to Blackpool, and on the way he sees a little lady that he used to know years ago,
and held hands with her in a pew. And this reminds him of church and conjures up the Christian ethic for a moment. And he feels a little tug inside him. Now, if the shara is going fast enough, he will be carried beyond the range of that stimulus very, very quickly and lapse back into his merrymaking. Now, in fact, the content of an individual man's mind in an untrained man depends entirely on the stimulus situation, both internal and external. And by internal we mean the memory stimulus of previous externals, including the ancestral ones. By the external one we mean the present physical situation. An untrained man has no control whatever over his thought processes, suffers all the time reaction. He is conjured to think things by the nature of the stimulus. The second part of this question says that he would be exposed to different intensities of stimulation elsewhere, and therefore his behaviour would alter. It says, in fact, what we were talking about last week, about the negative aspect of subjectivity. He is subjected or thrown under the stimulus. The stimulus is able to determine his action. Now, you know that Napoleon told one of his officers that he never met a new situation on the battlefield because he had already envisaged this situation and rehearsed mentally what he would do in all the possible alternatives. If we now ask ourselves what is the best thing to do to defeat this tendency to react, there are two modes we can adopt. One is the intellective mode, and the other one is the mode of volition. We've discussed this before in relation to paradox. In one case, we study the nature of the stimulus that is likely to arise, and we define the opposite of that stimulus, and we deliberately engram on the mind the opposite to the incoming stimulus, plus the pretended or held before relation. In other words, we rehearse the situation and we present the opposite stimulus from the memory to meet the extant physical stimulus. And the result is, when the two meet, a stasis. The thing stands still, and at the moment of standstill there is a possibility of decision. I'm going down there. I'm going to fall now. And that's the intellective way, to find the opposite of the kind of stimulus we're trying to conquer, and to imagine the stimulus coming before it actually comes, and to engram on our memory in relation with that stimulus the opposite of it, and by firing energy in through concentration, so to build up in the memory the opposite concept, that when the external stimulus does come, what it rouses instead of itself is the contrary. And the two elements are both presented in consciousness then simultaneously, and the result is you stand still. Now, when you've got yourself in a state of standstill, you will have to do something about it. You can't stand still permanently because the universe is not static. So you have to make a decision. It is therefore a moment of great danger, because in fact when you have suddenly discovered by this technique that you can control yourself in a situation, you can say, now I can control myself, I can afford to let go of it and indulge in the relation offered by the stimulus, because I know I can pull out. Now that is the worst thing you could do, because in fact it is again feeding energy into the thing you are supposed to be controlling. And even when you have succeeded and made yourself stand still and are therefore free at that moment, when you will into the thing confident that you can pull out it again, the law of inertia operates. As soon as you put energy into it, then the thing is disequilibrated and it starts running into action.
and it will, unless you're a superman at concentration, run to each turn. That is to say, the energy will exhaust itself before you can stop again. So that if you do find yourself committed in that way, all you've got time to do is regret it. The best thing to do is to start rehearsing like mad that the next time that you see this opportunity, you will not decide to go into it to prove to yourself that you can control yourself. You'll be just satisfied to control yourself in the relation. Now, that is the intellective mode, to find the opposite type of stimulus to the one you want to defeat. The other method is simply chopping the whole process by act of will. This we said before, you practice by interspacing, by horse and cart, removing them one at a time and then contemplating the void, or by stopping a serial process, like we might say 1 + 1 = and don't allow the mind to complete the series. Now this exercise looks fairly easy until you try it. If you can say 1 + 1 = and nothing happened in your mind, you're actually doing very well. It is worth acquiring, because if you can actually do it with that, although you haven't gained the power to say 1 + 1 = and nothing happens, because you've changed the quality of the stimulus in objectifying it, in concreting it, taking it out of abstract mathematics into the realm of biology, you've introduced a new factor. Nevertheless, you have practiced a little bit in inhibiting. Now, if you can inhibit any serial presentation of that order where you have been led to believe there is a logical necessity, then you are on the way to becoming aware of what vacuum, voidity, emptiness, space, sunyata means, and you discover that far from being nothing, that which is in between and internal to all rotations is force. To become aware of space is to become aware of force. It is not to become aware of nothing as one word, but nothing as two words. It is no thing. That no thing is simply not a finite. And that which is not a finite is infinite. It is infinite force. Now, because it is infinite, you cannot objectify it. The human being, for security reasons, tends to objectify. To inhibit this tendency to objectify is an essential of evolving reflexive self-consciousness. If we contemplate simply the paper, look at it and allow nothing to form on it, if we succeed, it's a guarantee that we've done a certain amount of work already. Let's look at this white paper and try to see the white paper for a moment. If we're not careful, we will immediately see that there is a drawing showing through it. In other words, the mind tends to seek an object. Now that object is the same thing as death. If an object appears in the mind, the mind starts rotating round the circumscribing line. And as long as it is so rotating, it is necessarily bound, circumscribed, and the force available at that point is finited. If we then ignore that, just look at this line for a moment and say that line is not to be considered as a deposit of carbon upon the paper, but it's merely to remind us that a force rotates there and encloses a force and excludes a force, and that the three forces are not three separate forces and cannot be, because the nature of the absolute is continuous, it is not discrete. So the force outside and the force of the circumscription and the force inside are not three forces, although actually it appears so. Remember, the only differences in the world are differences of actuality. And that means KT. There must be a closure and an establishment before actuality can come to be. If we remove actuality, all we're removing is simply objectification. And when we remove objectification, we've got no thing, but we have the cause, that is the force, of all things. And this force, experienced immediately without objectification, is identical with our own will. If we get hold of ourself, not as an object, but as will, without edges, what we have got hold of is the space, the voidity, the vacuum of the absolute. And this is not nothing, one word, it is no thing, two words, the supreme non-duality. Now, because we are men, including the Vedas, we necessarily count as men. Men are counters. It means there is a motion within that substance which is objectified intelligence making a me. An I objectifies itself as a me, and the motion internal to that constitutes its menschlichkeit, or its tendency to count. Remember, if we take a substance and just look at the constituent motions traversing it, that is the meaning of counting. There is the substance itself, that's the M. The M is witness and equilibrated or balanced entity, and the N has a disequilibrated one. So that the M signifies substance, which means forces in equilibrium, and the N signifies motion, that is forces in disequilibrium. So to be man is to be a substance with internal motions. The internal motions are presented and constitute what we call thinking. Now, these motions are eternal. This process goes on. It goes on continuously through all beings. And in spite of that fact, we can stop it, although it is eternal and absolute. Because when we say stop it, we mean something very, very special. We mean to say we can take the spirit, which is moving, and we can do what Moses did with the serpent. We can crucify it in that zone, and we can put a dot in it. In other words, we can make a central concept to which we will refer all motion, and then we can ignore, not be innocent of, we can ignore the motion inside it and hold the concept. And the concept we're going to hold will be a paradoxical one, because we want to paralyze the tendency of the motions inside to objectify and fasten the consciousness. Consciousness itself is force infinite. If it objectifies, it concentrates, and then it doesn't do anything other than what the form allows it to do. So if a man objectifies as a little wheel wretched or something, and somebody identifies as a little metal finger, then the one turns round and the other says tick tick. Now, as long as the consciousness is so identified in both of them, their relation is kept up, and a definite amount of consciousness is involved in the identification and completely circumscribed by the form of the object in the identification. That is the same thing that we mean when we say the individual man, that is the formed man, is a machine. Insofar as we identify with ourselves, if I think I'm not a Bantu or something, then I would exclude from my consciousness all the forms relating to that particular. And in excluding them, I release myself from reacting mechanically at that level. The only way we can release ourselves from mechanical action is by non-identification, and to get it, we can do it in two ways, either by active will, immediate, say all form as such is circumscription, cross it out because it's finite. Assert the voidity immediately. That's the Southern school, the Zen school. It says don't try to think about it at all, cross it off. If you argue with a Turk about any subject at all, he just points up and down and crosses it off. Because he says, in fact, you've done this. You've made a dichotomy out of the non-dual. So whatever you say, cross it off. That's the short way, the Southern school, the Zen school, on school called immediacy in European mysticism. The other way is to get another ratchet form and turn it the opposite way to the way that would fit with it, and the result is they do. Now when the two forms cannot function at all, the mind seizes up. You can do this experimentally with your own mind. You can take a pair of contrary ideas and insist on holding them both at once. You can assert, if you like, that that paper is black. We know it's black because the light that comes from the bulb up there is hitting the paper and being reflected from the paper into the eye, and it is only because the paper is rejecting the light that the light is coming into our eye, and therefore the paper is black. It looks white. It is really black. So we look at this apparently white paper and assert that it is black, and we can see that it is white, and we are asserting it is black. And so we call it black-white paper. Simultaneously, in 1984, and Animal Farm and things like that, you get this statement, freedom is bondage. Now, we've already demonstrated that the dome in freedom is bondage. There is no freedom other than self-bondage. The man must bond himself, tie himself to a concept of freedom, or he will be bound by somebody else's concept. It's a very simple either or. We have then the two ways of controlling the situation, either by direct intellectual opposition causing a seizure of the mental processes by asserting a pair of opposites, that's the paradox, or by an act of will crossing them all off simply because they are forms. Now obviously, if human beings were equipped at birth with the power to cross all the forms off and chose to exercise it, as fast as babies were born, if they exercised it, they would immediately become unborn and disappear, and the world would then no longer be problematic. What we find in fact is that the babies enter this world remarkably identified, considering they're supposed to have never been here before. They're equipped with all sorts of tendencies. They are able to support their own weight, hanging onto a pole at birth. Within an hour of birth, they can hold their own weight. They can suck, they can breathe, they can kick, they can scream. They can do a remarkable lot of things, all of them calculated to perpetuate their existence in this world, which means that they come in already identified. Now, it's obvious that if a baby comes in identified and derives from the absolute, then the absolute must have precipitated it into identification. Because you cannot say of the baby itself that it has reflexive self-consciousness and is deliberately willing objectification. So it has been objectified by a force superior to itself. Now this force we call God. God, the Father, because Father means generator. So the Absolute spins energy in and makes a child. Now that child is now objectified. The whole ingoing process is a process moving towards objectification. Now the ingoing process, you remember, we use the symbol Saturn to express, which makes God the Father equivalent to Saturn. This is why William Blake said that everybody's worshipping the devil under the name of Jehovah. What he meant to say was that creation is necessarily arcing, circumscribing. Circumscribing is finiting, and that is the same as binding, tying up, putting in chain. But God, in his infinite wisdom, must be doing it because he wants to, because he can't be under constraint, because being infinite, there is none other to constrain him. So he must be willing objectification of finite for a definite purpose, which is God so loved the world. So he has a purpose. So he puts a certain amount of spirit into a finite form and crucifies it. that cross inside the circle represents the form of experience through which you're going to have to go. It comes in into a physical body and is limited by it, and immediately upon extrusion in the world is subject to a big bang from somebody's arm, which is already fairly well developed. That's to encourage him to breathe. Now, we come into the world, as St. Paul says, first a physical body, and out of this we have to grow a spiritual body. Let's see why God bothers to objectify at all. Rub out all the objectifications in the immediate sudden moment. Let's all be zenith for a moment. Rub them all out. Leave ourselves with the infinite. This is why, of course, in the name of Jehovah, the name itself means male, female. Yah and they, Jehovah, means the same as Adam and Eve. It means man, woman. And as to the woman, it said, I want to create. And as to the man, he said, well, I'll show you how. Namely, formally. So there is a simultaneous wanting and a power to fulfill the want in the absolute. It then spins in and makes a world. All things are made in the same way by the inspin of the infinite onto a centre and a generation in that circumscription of a finite. Now it must do so to get something out of it, because you never put things in except to get them out. So when the infinite puts itself into the finite, it must be that when it comes out it will get something worth having. Now, if we remove the concept of opposition, we remove the concept of friction. If we remove the concept of friction, we cannot develop the results of friction. The absolute is an equable light. Yes, in the Bhagavad Sudha of the Tibetans, is a whole chapter about the equable light. About the fact that everybody at death sees this light, and few people manage to retain it because it's equable. If you manage to hang on to it, you're all right. But hanging on is a finiting activity. There's a paradox in it. The absolute is an equable light, and yet it rolls in and creates darkness. When it comes out, it doesn't come out as an equable light. It comes out brighter than it went in. Let's imagine now that we have an infinity of light, spirit, force. It goes in, rotates, and overshadows itself and puts its light out. Now, in overshadowing itself, it is actually packing energy in to a finite container. The more it packs in, the more interference there is in that zone, the darker it gets. This word dark, dark, means interference. So if it keeps unpacking it until it becomes saturated with light, it goes black. Hence the alchemical and Rose Cross statement, from excess of light, darkness. Now it isn't posing the darkness has an end in itself to retain it. But when it has gone dark, if it insists on putting more into it, then quite suddenly it incandesces. The dark now suddenly flashes out, and the light that flashes out is brighter than the equable light from which it derived. We've now got an individual light, as well as an infinite absolute light. And the process goes on. Throughout space, it keeps turning in, making little black awkward agates, and driving more energy into them until finally they suddenly incandesce. This is funkeling. Nice way of funkeling, isn't it? This sparking goes on, and induces in the infinite equable light an infinite number of individuated lights. And all the individuated lights as seen in the second half of Mr. Watson's question, are factually subjected to different intensities of stimulation, which is the same thing as saying that all the individuated lights are uttering different notes, and they are shining forth different colours. In the absolute, there is no tone as such, because tone implies unification, and the absolute is not monistic, it is non-dual. When it brings to be the first great sphere, it has brought the first tone to exist and the first equilibration colour, the white. When further involvements produce individuated lights, there arrives in each individuated light a centre for the distribution of a new colour and a new tone. So the whole of art, in terms of visual and audio tactual experience, as we know it, and all that we call value, springs out of the creation of individuation centres which have been precipitated by the non-individuated, the infinite, for its own good pleasure. So if you find out why am I made by God, the answer is to enjoy God and to know Him. That's the dogmatic statement about Him. God loves to create, and He loves His creatures to love that He creates. But that doesn't mean we can all immediately start enjoying ourselves, because some of us have only just been precipitated into the darkness, and we're not nearly so dark as we'll have to be before we can strike an individual light. Hence the necessity for prodigality. If we don't consciously survey our wickednesses and consider the nature of them, we cannot become that individual light that the infinite has precipitated us to be. You know those Laodicean gentlemen who will not blow hot and will not blow cold? The infinite spews them out of the mouth. The mouth is the great sphere of the universe. And if they won't blow hot or cold, they are pushed to the perimeter by the forces that are blowing hot, and they're then floated back into the infinite and absorbed because they're no good. But if they blow hot or cold within, then strife occurs, and out of this comes this inner characterization symbolized by the cross. And this characterization is the same thing as tonality in music, or colour harmony in the visual arts. In order to get a good unique colour, we have to go very dark first, suffer various crucifixions, and then emerge with a consciousness of the peculiar steps of our crucifixion. So although we all, as individuals, derive from the non-individual, God the Father, when we do come to be individual, we are destined to be returned to consciousness of the Father, and instead of being, as misunderstood Buddhism asserts, lost in the sea of infinity, we always retain the form of our initial precipitation point, which means we have a unique value once we've been through the mill and come out on the other side. Now, to guard against mere intellectualism in relation to paradox, the tendency as men is to think, and to think, as we've said before, is to do what would be thinking only in the mind. In the gross material world, we come up against situations. In the gross material world, we do find a few pleasures, but we also get a lot of kicks. Now, the kicks in the gross world tend to force us out of the gross world and turn gay into gay. And if we allow
the pains of gross material experience to force us into the thinking world only, we will become intellectualists and we will dodge all the painful situations of the gross material world. If we do that, we will never strike a light individually. We cannot strike a light except in exposure in the gross world. The thing about, say, Gurdjieff, for instance, was that he began with a hard G. That's his dominant concept. He goes into the gross world and he does things in the gross world because his grandmother said he'd either have to do that or go to school, accordingly. He exposes himself and discovers things about himself in the gross material relation that he could not possibly discover in the merely intellectual relation, where he could only say, if I were to expose myself, I might experience certain things. When we hear people saying, if I were to do so and so, and then they don't do it, we know that their furniture of form in consciousness is insubstantial, and it is quite useless at the gross material level. Now, a king, as we've said before, is a man who has an idea and puts that idea in to the gross material world. If he cannot take his idea and put it in to the gross material world, then he is not a king. When we talk about paradox, we're talking about that which is beyond para, opinion, the docs. And that is the same as para, dice, where dice means duality. Beyond duality, beyond opinion. Now we have to be very, very careful that we do not reduce this to an intellectual proposition. If we do, it will do us no good at all, and we will fail to make contact with space dynamically. Paradox, beyond opinion, paradise, beyond duality, is not simply an idea that intellectual ideas are in pairs of opposites, and that you can intellectually assert both. It is not such an idea only. It is a statement that beyond opinions, beyond dualities, there is space, and that this space in between is alive. It is vital. It is intelligent. And this space, if it weren't an abuse of a word, we could call concrete. But we can't call it concrete because concrete means grown together. Together grown. Concrete means grown together. As if it were merely an intellectual proposition, we will not be able to feel the dynamic space between objects. If we identify with physical bodies in this room, our own, each one of us, then we finite our understanding to the level of that body. But if we dare to feel what's going on in between bodies in the space, we will actually feel a different tension between this body and every other body in the room. And the tension will not be the same for all other bodies, but it will be a unique difference between this body and every other body. Now you can do that because of the nature of space now as an exercise, without bothering to get up from where you are. But if you don't know each other very intimately, and therefore you can feel the situation without much intellectual blockage. If for a few seconds you just deliberately try to feel the space between your body and another body in the room, and feel the quality of the feeling between them, and then change it to another body, and feel that, and compare it with the first, then change it with another one and feel that, change it with another one and feel that. Throughout the room, you will find a definite feeling tone difference as you're simply doing it. And it is not an intellectual creation. It is a felt fact. And it has to do with the tension between forms. You know, if we take, the tonic and the third and the fifth, and play them in music. As soon as we do that, we find a peculiar tendency in the tones and between the tones to want to do something. if we play a minor third instead, we find that the tension alters between them. Now this tension itself is the product of the fact that each tone is a vortical center of infinity, and therefore is straining the space between. And according to the distance between these centers, it is only distance in the tonal scale, according to the distance between them, so is the frequency. A great distance we call a long wave, and a short distance we will call a short wave. And it is this difference between them, the difference, the duality in their bearing and the duality in their doing, that we feel in the interspace between us. Now you can do this, I hope you've all been doing it surreptitiously in the last few seconds. You can do this either at home or anywhere else, in the bath or on the bus. Whatever you do it, if you actually tell yourself the truth that space is not empty in the ordinary sense of the term, it is only empty in the dynamic sense that we've just said. It is literally full of frequencies, and all you have to do is increase sensitivity to them. Until you can feel them, you cannot manipulate them. When you can feel them, you cannot help manipulating them, so you better be careful. To become aware of a thing in your organism is to change it. Remember, consciousness is a catalyst. As soon as you become aware of a force in your body, its character alters. You cannot become aware of it without changing it, because to become aware of it is to induce energy of consciousness into the zone where it is. So simply to think of somebody is to change the dynamic relationship within that body. The animals are most obvious at showing this immediately because they're not conceptualized. But it's just the same in human beings. If you think of somebody, if they're in farthest antipodes or something, whatever they are, it makes no difference. As soon as you think of that person, you have changed the dynamic relation between yourself and that person. And at the same time, the interspace between you is different, and therefore the pull or push between you has increased. You cannot think without producing an energy change, and that must either move you further apart or draw you closer together. This is simply because space is what it is. Space is force. We all know things that we tend to ignore. The room is full of radio waves now, full of cosmic radiations, full of all sorts of marvelous radio programs. And if we don't turn the radio on, we don't get them. But they're there. Everybody knows it. Today it's a commonplace for the schoolboy. And yet, we don't hear them under normal conditions simply because we don't want to. We're busy. Once upon a time, man did want to, and he could feel a tree, he could hear a tree, he could see a tree simultaneously. But in so doing, his natural tendency to interfere with things was inhibited. Now we've said that when a man is precipitated in as a baby, he is darkened and turned into an egotist. Now, when William Blake says, "Let God go into a circle and see how he goes on," he was merely making a metaphysical statement. As soon as the equable light diminishes and darkens, the only way that being knows who it is, what it is, and what it can do is by having a go. Now we need an infinite space to show the next diagram. I'll finish a bit more space. We'll repeat this as a diagram. There is a gross being coming to existence. It is dark. It just doesn't know what it can do or who it is. Who it is an intelligence with a potential of action. What it is a gross, substantialized being made by that intelligence. What it can do, it does not yet know. Now, supposing it sends out a force, like Omar Khayyam did. I sent a message to the infinite
something in that afterlife spell. Now, supposing it travels out infinitely, just keeps on going, then if that is so, this being cannot possibly know what it has sent out. It's quite impossible for a finite being sending out an impulse or an action, if that impulse travels infinitely, for the being to know what it is and hit the being. Now, on the return, the being knows the quality of what it sent out in relation to the thing that reflected it. And this is the ground of reflexive self-consciousness. We do something, pretend for a moment that's an actor. I was talking to some actors the other day, and they were complaining about certain things, about the bad audience they had. And I said, supposing you had a very, very good audience who appreciated all your jokes and even anticipated them and gave you a round every time you opened your mouth, how would you know how good you were? And they all said immediately it wouldn't do, because they would not be able to evaluate their own progress. So they actually have to have something here, a firmament or resistance barrier, and it mustn't be too ready to respond. It must be a little inertic, so that it doesn't give them back in its purity and immediately what is sent out. But there is a time lag, and what comes back is slightly distorted, slightly muffled, slightly covered and choked. Then you send out another impulse and see what happens to that one when it comes back. And you just go about sending them out, and they keep coming round. The whole space is traversed by lines going out and back to every finite centre within macrocosmos. It is these lines that have led Einstein to believe that space-time is curved. Now, this gross body now finds other gross bodies, and it finds, if it fires a stimulus at a gross body, it gets a quicker response than if it fires one at the macrocosmic logos. So, it finds it can discover its own capacities better and quicker by simply kicking the shin of the little boy next door. And gives an immediate response, or fairly. Therefore, he tends to drift into relation with more and more of these little black boys in their search for God. And they keep kicking each other. And in so doing, they are learning the nature of the stimulus they have sent out. Now, this is a strange fact, and if you care to think about it and then watch very carefully, you will find out that in general, people are not talking to you at all. This is a strange fact. People are not having conversations. They are shooting out remarks to see what happens. And the remarks, when they come back, give them some information about reality. Now, if you know that fact, and you verify it with a little test by firing something out consciously and deliberately and seeing what happens, you will gradually become aware of your own nature. Because when the reaction from another being attacked by one of your stimuli hits you, it produces a response. You might say, well, I'm going to insult that man to see how he reacts to an insult. So you insult him. Straight away a reaction comes, a long arm, punch on the nose. Now, you can watch your own nose-end reaction to the reaction that you initiated with your original stimulus. This causes a growth of self-knowledge. Therefore, there's no immediate danger of you overdoing it. Because, like the baby, is very aware that it won't tumble over the edge of the staircase as soon as it can crawl, although it's never fallen before, there's a natural tendency for the eye to blink when a bit of dust goes near it. And so there's a natural tendency for the body not to endanger itself unduly. In fact, it requires quite an effort of will to insult a man three times larger or heavier than yourself, who looks rather ferocious. But whatever you do, if you deliberately become conscious and make these statements to see the reaction that other being gives to you,
What you have to do in order to evolve quickly is to be more concerned with the reaction that you have to his reaction than you have with his reaction to your stimulus. That way you can evolve very quickly. And it immediately inverts the usual order of affairs. Because usually a person fired out a stimulus, looks, grins, and says, I got under his skin that time. He's not concerned with his own reaction if somebody gets under his skin as a lesson to be learned. You're too busy being injured. So, in this situation, where all these precipitated, finite beings who are all on their way to doing a bit of private fumbling and making lovely bright lights and new tones, new non-tonic bass music and so on, as they're all evolving towards it, they're all at different levels. They're all at different ages. Some people are millions of years old and some people are just born now. And that has to be recognized. So that if you see anybody behaving what you call badly, you should, out of what is called charity, assume they're a bit younger than you are to begin with. They've not been around so many times. And bring in always into yourself this consciousness that you are being fed through and by space. That space is not nothing. Christ says, he is the big macrocosmic logos, I am the vine. It's a funny vine because it grows inside itself and it makes branches on the inside like this. These are grapes, you see. The apes of wrath, as they call them. Now these grapes growing on the inside vine are the individual human beings. Christ says, I am the vine, my Father, God the Father, is the husbandman, and he will cut off any unprofitable branch, and if there is a profitable branch, he will purge it so that it brings forth more fruit. So in either case, we're going to get it roughly. We're either going to be purged because we're doing well, or we're going to be smacked a bit because we're not. This is one of the hard sayings in the NT, or TNT as it should be called. Now, once we've understood this, this space which is God the Father is infinite, goes right through macrocosmos, right through all contingent beings, is in the very centre of every egotist, and it is this space force, no resistance, no character, no cross, no crown. So this same absolute force appears as devil or tempter, which is why in the Lord's Prayer it says, lead us not into temptation, and it is a prayer said to God the Father. Temptation is temporal presentation or the serial processes of relation within the macrosphere. And when we think we've had enough bashing, enough of the joys of temptations and their results, then we say the Lord's Prayer. And at first we don't mean what we say when we say, lead us not into temptation. So you were a bit like St. Augustine, who said, deliver us, O Lord, from the concupiscence of the flesh, but not today. And when he said this, he was talking about a fact inside himself. Some part of him that had been hurt in a painful situation said, I think I'd rather be good. So lots of other parts that are well shielded by nature, of necessity, said, well, we've not been hurt yet, so we will carry on and fulfill our experiential cycle. Now, when it is said, I believe, help thou mine unbelief, it is another aspect of the same thing. A little portion of us that has had a really good bashing says, I do believe in you now, you see. And a lot of you said, oh, go on, don't be stupid. See? Now, the funny thing is, the part that's saying don't be stupid is this dark part that doesn't know anything at all about anything except in so far as it can fire out a stimulus and get back a reaction. But as the whole process is initiated from infinity, this dark part misbehaving itself and occupying open borstals and being delinquent and so on is not frowned upon by God the Father, because it is the only process whereby these beautiful fairy lights can be made. There is no other process. There's only one process. This is why the cosmic Christ refuses to condemn a manifest sinner. And why this macrocosmic self, the Christ self, takes upon itself the sins of all those individuals. They are within it. In him we live, move and have our being. Every sin, every contingent clash reverberates through the whole of macrocosmic space, and the macrocosmic self actually suffers, that is in passive relationship with the violence initiated by those finite individuals. So it isn't as if really he could dodge it, because we're inside him, and he's no more opportunity to dodge us in our violence internally than a mother has the possibility of dodging the baby she's carrying when it kicks. She could complain and she could smack herself in the rough zone where she felt the kick, but he's already turned over and he's kicking somewhere else. Now, this has to be realized, that God has a genuine problem himself in making this universe, and this universe is his son, the Logos, and precipitating internally further sons, because we are all sons, and these sons going through this process of darkening and egotism as part of their necessary characterization process must kick, and these kicks must reverberate back through the macrocosmos. So it is quite useless to condemn anybody for anything they do, because what they do is a product of the total constellation of forces, the gestalt of the macrocosmos itself. The macrocosmos does not condemn any single one of them. God the Father, who runs right through the lot, does not condemn them. And nevertheless, there is a strange fact of judgment. There is a judgment, because each one of these, when it sends out an impulse, is bound to get it back again. And that is the judgment. The reaction to our stimuli that we release is the judgment. And just as there is an individual judgment for each man, so there is a collective judgment for macrocosmos. And it is this collective judgment of all the beings within macrocosmos that is called the last judgment, the final one, because there is a definite amount of energy involved in it, and a definite number of impulses for each individual to come to his level, and a term, therefore, for a collective equilibration of the whole process, and the final judging or reaction relation establishment throughout the whole process. I'll just repeat this fact, that we must be careful of intellectualism. The intellect is an instrument of analysis, and we analyze or make running serpents loose. We loosen the forces in order to see what they are. But when we loosen them, we have not destroyed the continuity of the Absolute, the seamlessness of the Absolute. The intellect has split reality, and behind it, the feeling must retain the unity. The man who analyzes with his intellect only and kills his feeling, kills himself, cuts himself out from space consciousness, and as soon as he's lost spatial consciousness, he falls to the gross material contingent level, becomes in act a material being, subject to gross material law, and acted upon from above by beings more sensitive than himself, who can push him around because he's identified with his gross material body. To identify with an analytical process, an intellectual process, that severs bodies is therefore to go under the law of separateness, and to become unaware of the field forces, which can only be known by making feeling more sensitive. To make feeling more sensitive of the interspace is actually to become spiritually aware. In Buddhism, the doctrine of the three bodies of the Buddha, the Trikaya, there is a dharma body, a kind of law body, that is a sambhoga kaya, a body of bliss, the whole feeling body, and a nirmana kaya body, which is, kaya means body, the body of transformation, whereby we take our gross material body, and by progressive exposures and testings and so on, and increases of sensitivity of feeling, we turn that body, as St. Paul says, from a gross material body into a spiritual body by increasing sensitivity to the forces traversing it. And the whole thing depends on clarity of analysis as a first step to climbing out of the whole thing, and when the analysis is completed, to avoid falling to bits, which is what analysis does to you, to practice feeling the interspaces, the mark of Christ, the mark of Buddha, and so on, is calm passion, that is, feeling with other beings. And the only way you can do that is by becoming more and more sensitive to the interspaces between you.
Sympathy and compassion, how would you distinguish?
Between a Greek and a Latin concept, really. Sympathy means same feeling, compassion means with feeling. You could feel the same as another person, and yet you could say, well, so I'm feeling the same as you, so what? That would be sympathy. In compassion, you feel with them. Not only the same, but you also feel as if you are with them. If you remember that form itself is only a modality of the Absolute, then compassion is a necessity. And if we say that we are not experiencing it, or sympathy, what we are really doing is deceiving ourselves. It is impossible not to feel what is going on in South Africa now, but when you do feel it, when it's presented to you, you can refuse to look at it. But it is an act of will to refuse to look at it. So that everybody spontaneously feels, because they are, before they are existent, a field. An infinite field of intelligent force. So this field consciousness is prior to their individuated consciousness, because this infinite is prior to this precipitation. So the feeling experience is prior to the intellectual analytical experience. And it has to be regained, plus this heightened awareness, the sharpened, brightened light, which was the purpose for which the infinite finited itself.
So they become identified with this compassion. This would be the fall into the emotional upset, wouldn't it? They become emotionally involved with all the feelings which... Or even individually?
Not necessarily. Emotion is outflowing motion. Mm. You see? And it could be out of control, or it could be in control. It's possible to feel compassion without becoming overthrown emotionally.
Mm.
You see? The danger of emotionalism, to make an ism out of it, to build it into a sentential system, the ism means, is that it causes you to identify and destroy your efficiency in the relationship. Whereas compassion increases efficiency in the relationship because it makes you aware of the feeling determinants in other beings. One of the things, you take a man with a poker face. He specializes in not exhibiting his feelings. Now, if you get a man playing cards with a poker face, gentleman opposite to him, he feels a bit upset because he can't read that man's emotion. There was a fellow interviewed recently, Alexander, a chess player. He said that when he played with Alekhine on one occasion, he had heard that Alekhine, when he was emotionally disturbed, started twisting his hair. When he noticed he was twisting his hair, then he thought, now I can win, he's upset. And he himself got excited and made a mistake. Whereupon Alekhine stopped twisting his hair again. I know this fellow, Alexander, and he got excited at the thought of beating a
this world beater. If only he could have inhibited this at that moment, he might have won the game. When you are in compassion with somebody, it does not mean that you are emotionally out of control. That means to say, emotional lack of control means that the energy started to flow out, and you're really no longer merely compassionate. There is more energy going into the situation from you than the situation warrants. Now, in a perfect relation of compassion, you can feel how much is wanted of emotional exhibition to stabilize it. And there may be, in some cases, an occasion when you would have to say, oh my word, you see, and that would stabilize the situation. And in another situation, you might have to shed 2 dozen crocodile tears, you see. In each situation, there will be an emotional need on the part of another person locked up in his dark shell. But emotional leakage is not presupposed by compassion or sympathy. You've always got to keep your control if you want to have proper compassion. And because of fear of emotionalism, particularly in men, the tendency is to formulate intellectually to get rid of this emotionalism. And if the analysis goes too far, you get rid of it completely. So you get a man like Charles Darwin complaining in his old age that he was no longer able to appreciate music at all. His intellect had cut into him so strongly that literally nothing happened to him when he heard a great piece of music. And he thought he'd lost something. He had. What he'd done was identify with the mechanical process of intellect and put a super stress on it so that his feeling like died. He was still underneath, but he hadn't got the wherewithal to pull it up. In fact, he didn't even have the concept that it was there to pull up, as a materialist. He just thought it was a thing, discrete, detachable, that he had lost. Not simply a capacity that he had suppressed for scientific reasons.
What was the price he had to pay for what he did?
Well, it was a price that he did pay. If he had thought more carefully, he would have been more truthful. Then he wouldn't have had to pay such a price. You know that Darwin altered successive editions of his greatest work to keep it in pace with fact, without admitting, without writing in the preface that he had altered it. And that wasn't honest. Mm-hmm. And the desire to be right was more important to him. And it was that kind of thing that made him kill the feeling. If he had been really sensitive, he would have said, that's not nice. I lost mentioning in the preface. Nobody reads prefaces in any case.
In Manchester Street. Mr. Halliday, there's tensions between two finites. When I asked this question about space, I was thinking of it more in a literal sense. I've had a discussion with a gentleman who is a great science fiction addict. Mm-hmm. And he's very taken up with this business of the possibility of exploration of space, mm-hmm. at the physical level. Mm-hmm. And in considering this question, I suddenly thought you had told us about sidereal, solar, lunar, mm-hmm. terrestrial influences, mm-hmm. and that man's substance is modified by these influences, mm-hmm. and in its turn brings about a certain psyche in his nature.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not that when he, if he ever manages to get into some contrivance which will say shoot him off to Venus, mm-hmm. will not the whole ratio of forces in the universe playing upon him have suddenly altered to such an extent that he must become an entirely different thing altogether, not a man any longer?
Well, because of this danger, you will notice that the men who have been chosen out of all the volunteers to go on these space expeditions are not just ordinary men. They're men highly formulated, and the 7 of them chosen in America are all religious. Which means they have a dominant concept. Now, these men are rehearsed. They have faith, which is an essential, in transcendence, so that whatever formal situation they get into,
they had something superior to the formal situation. You know that they put them in various contrivances and disorientate them, and they're then attacked by various fantasies. And this is how they test the space worthiness of these fellows. Those fellows with faith in transcendence come off better than the others, because they say, oh, this is only dizziness. No, I'm terribly dizzy, this is awful. This is dizziness. This is a sort of formal manifestation. And beyond all this, there is God, absolute, in whom I believe. So let the dizziness come, and let the strange beings with the long green hairs on the end of their nose come too. They're still only forms. You know, a lot of the Americans who've been tested for this space stuff recently have been frightened and been seeing Kremlins on the dashboard. You know? They've been seeing fantastic figures, and those are the projections of their fears. Now, if a man will panic under test conditions when he knows he's in the laboratory, think what will happen to him if he's fired out into space.